Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 122, In Search of Flavor. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I am Roger, your host, and this is the podcast. It's all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, learning new things, tips and inspiration for home cooks everywhere. That's what we're doing here on the Kitchen Counter Podcast. So thanks for being here today. I'm going to be talking about something that comes up a lot whenever you talk about cooking or food or getting in the kitchen, making, baking, whatever it is. And that is this idea of flavor. And I'm going to be talking about a couple of different ideas of flavor, and we'll just say capital F flavor and lowercase flavor. And this is largely inspired by some comments I've seen in the Facebook group for the show, the Kitchen Counter Coffee Break. When people ask to join the group, I ask them a couple of simple questions. One of which is, what do you consider your level of skill as a home cook? And then the other question is, what is it that you'd like to learn more about cooking or in the kitchen? Or what is it that you'd like to get out of this group? And one thing that seems to come up fairly often, I would say at least 30 or 40% of the time when people answer those questions in some form or another, that second question in particular, they say something like, I want to understand flavor, or I want to understand how to make my food taste better, or I want to understand how flavors work so I can improvise more in the kitchen. Sometimes they say it directly, they want to understand flavor. Sometimes it's not quite phrased that way, but it's really all about the same thing. So today on this show, we're going to talk about flavor, and we're going to talk about capital F flavor and little f flavor, and I'm going to get into that in a minute. Before I get into the meat of the show, though, you know, I always like to just drop a couple of quick housekeeping items here. One of which, of course, is always that if you'd like to get in touch with me, you can really do that any way you prefer. But a couple of really easy ways to do it is to send me an email over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. For those of you who have done it that way, you know, I read and answer all of my emails, and sometimes I'll even bring up the email content or the show idea or whatever on the podcast. So feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com is a great way to get a hold of me. Of course, another really good way to do that is to send me a message over on Facebook at facebook.com/kitchencounterpodcast, or join the Facebook group, and then I'm in there, and we have several other listeners in there as well. We do fun things like cooking challenges and share pictures of things we're cooking or growing in our gardens or ask questions, that sort of a thing. And I don't know the Facebook link because it's this long, weird number letter string, but if you just go to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group, that will redirect you to the Facebook group page, and there you can ask to join, and we'll let you in, and you can start interacting with all of us and sharing your questions and ideas. That would be really awesome. And of course, anything I mention in this episode of the show, I will put into the show notes over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/122. So go there and you will find links to cookbooks or anything else I mentioned, recipes as well, kitchencounterpodcast.com/122. All right, without any further ado or housekeeping or ramblings on, let's dive right into the topic today. This is In Search of Flavor. You know, flavor is a huge, huge concept. It's a big topic, and truthfully, and I say this about a lot of the things I bring up on the show, and it's a bit cliche probably at this point, but it's no less true in that it's such a big topic, it could probably, and I'm sure it probably does, have entire podcasts, not just episodes, but entire shows dedicated to this idea of flavor. I mean, flavor is why chefs take an entire lifetime to master their craft, right? It's mostly about flavor and how to construct dishes and how to make them taste amazing. So flavor is not something to be taken lightly. For a home cook like you and I, it's not the be-all and end-all necessarily. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but it's still important, and it's good to understand kind of the fundamentals of what makes flavor. And I mentioned in the intro that I kind of group flavor into like capital F flavor and little f flavor. Well, what do I mean by that exactly? Well, simply put, I think little f flavor is essentially how something tastes to you, how an ingredient tastes, and how you cook that ingredient or prepare that ingredient or combine that ingredient with other ingredients, how it ends up tasting. That to me is little F flavor. That just is taste. That is just basically it to me. Capital F flavor adds in some more complexity to this concept of flavor. And capital F flavor not only takes into account ingredients and cooking methods, which I just mentioned, but it also takes into account other things like the physical nature of flavor and taste, the mental nature of taste, the environmental factors that can impact flavor. So when you take the ingredients and the method you're using as a home cook, and you factor in all these other things that aren't necessarily under your direct control, you end up with what I call capital F flavor, or just flavor writ large, the broad umbrella of what we'll talk about flavor. And I'm going to go into all of that a little bit in this show. This isn't probably going to be a really long, in-depth, or multi-part episode, so I'm not probably going to be able to do it as much justice as I'd like to for just because of time constraints, and also because obviously I'm not a master chef expert on flavor, but I'm going to do my best to break it down in terms from a home cook's perspective. So I'm going to break this down and talk about this in terms of those four components: the methods and ingredients that home cooks deal with and how that impacts flavor. I'm going to talk about that second, but first I want to get into this idea of like the personal, physical, mental, and environmental aspects of flavor. So without going any farther, let's just define flavor a little bit. So what is flavor anyway? At this point, you're probably thinking, come on, Roger, this isn't that complicated. Flavor is how something tastes. And that is part of it. That's certainly part of it. But it's a little bit more complicated than that, in my opinion. I mean, we could go to the dictionary and pull out a definition of flavor. In fact, I did that just to share that. So I went over to Merriam-Webster.com and looked up flavor, and they say the quality, first definition is the quality of something that affects the sense of taste. And then the second definition is the blend of taste and smell sensations evoked by a substance in the mouth, which is as good a place as any to start. So at its most basic, then, flavor is sensory, and it's made in our brains. It's a subjective thing, but it comes from the chemicals and the signals we pick up from our taste buds on our tongues and the smells in what hits our olfactory senses and our noses, right? And there's even more than that, of course. There's the visual appeal of the food, the way it feels texture-wise in our hands, in our mouths. But in this view of flavor, it's largely a physical sensation. And as such, the taste of something plays a large part of flavor. Back on episode 78 of this show, I covered a topic called the introduction to the five tastes. If you've listened to that or if you're familiar, you know those are typically referred to as the sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami tastes. Now, flavor as a physical sensation, as we interpret it as people, is largely built around these five tastes. But, you know, even so, even from a purely physical, personal standpoint, flavor is subjective. So here's a simple example. It could be like a thought experiment. So let's say a friend and I go down to the farmer's market and we see a stand selling fresh blackberries. We find a big basket. We want to pick them up, but we want to test them first, right? We want to make sure they're good before we spend money on blackberries. So we pick one up, and I try one first, and I say, wow, this is a perfect blackberry. It's just perfectly ripe. It's flavorful. It's fantastic. Then my friend grabs a blackberry from the same basket, and let's just assume for a moment that these two blackberries are identical to each other, just for the sake of this thought experiment. My friend will try that blackberry and kind of make a squinchy face and say, yikes, that blackberry is way too tart. It's not nearly sweet enough. So even though my friend and I are tasting the exact same blackberry, we're coming away with very different perceptions of what we think a blackberry should taste like. Clearly, I like my blackberries a little more on the tart side, and my friend likes blackberries that aren't tart at all and are very ripe, maybe to the point of almost being overripe and sweet. So we both agree that they taste like blackberry, but we can't necessarily agree on what exactly a blackberry should taste like, or what's the ideal flavor of a blackberry, because taste is subjective. Now, that's just one aspect of flavor and taste, okay? That's the purely physical. This is how my genes and genetics are. This is how my tongue is built. This is how my taste buds are laid out. These are the tastes and the flavors that I'm more sensitive to or not. And as a home cook, cooking for yourself or for other people, right, you have no control, virtually no control over that. So that's just something to keep in mind. That's the doorway to taste and flavor is through the individual, and the way they taste and perceive flavor just from their physical and genetic makeup is going to differ. I know that sounds a little out there for our purposes, but again, I just kind of want to paint this capital F flavor rather than just narrowing down on the ingredients and the method. So what's the other part of flavor that's personal? It's not necessarily or overtly physical. And this is something else we don't have a lot of control over, but this would be like the mental component of flavor. You might even call it the emotional component of flavor. And to me, this is one of the most mysterious and interesting aspects of flavor. So think about this, and we all have these experiences, and as I talk about this, we will all easily be able to think of examples of this phenomena, right? So flavor can be affected by emotional connections to certain ingredients or recipes, or to the memories we associate with certain foods, or people connected with certain foods, right? That's why for so many of us, we hold the food of our childhood so dear. Right, that's why we can go to the fanciest Italian restaurant we can think of in our neighborhood or in our city or whatever, and we go and we order their spaghetti and meatballs. And while they're really good spaghetti and meatballs, they just don't hold a candle to grandma's spaghetti and meatballs. They just don't taste quite as good. The flavor isn't quite there. As good as they are, they're not grandma's spaghetti and meatballs, right? I'm struck by how often I try to recreate the very simple food that my mother would make all the time. And I am just struck by the fact that I rarely can nail it like she could nail it. I'm using the same recipe, right? I guess you could say the ingredients could be a little bit different. They've changed over time. But by and large, I just can't quite nail the flavors that my mom could. And chances are it's probably not anything to do with the physical aspect of the food. It probably has to do with my emotional connection to the food that my mom made, right? Can't we all remember for the first time in our lives when we went over to somebody else's house and we had dinner at somebody else's house, maybe apart from your family or whatever, and they made a dish that you had at home a lot. Maybe your mom made it, your grandma made it, your dad made it, whatever. And you were really excited to have it. And it comes out and you're thinking, this doesn't look anything like what that food should look like. My example, just to use spaghetti again, I remember going over to my brother and his wife's house when I was younger, and they were making spaghetti. And I thought, I like spaghetti. This is going to be great. And I was a little bit of a picky eater back then. And the spaghetti came out, and it looked like spaghetti, but when the sauce came out, it was like, what is that? Yes, it was a tomato-y sauce, but there was all sorts of crazy stuff in there. There were olives and peppers and big chunks of onions and probably a whole bunch of other stuff I can't even remember. And I thought, that doesn't look anything like mom's spaghetti. And therefore, as flavorful and as tasty as it probably was, I couldn't get past my like emotional connection to what I thought the flavor of spaghetti should be. And we probably all have examples like that. So that's just one idea or one aspect of how the emotional connection to food can impact a food's flavor for us. And on a related note, it's interesting to me to think that the way I interact with people I love and the people around me with food, when I cook them food, my wife, my son, whoever else it is, that everything I do is building some sort of an emotional connection to the food that they're eating. Sometimes it's not always positive. Sometimes it can be a negative emotional connection to food, right? Again, we probably can all think of the one food that for whatever reason we do not like at all, because even though the food might be perfectly fine, it might even taste good, we just can't handle it because there's some sort of an event or an emotion connected with that food in our past that prevents us from really enjoying it. So that's the other part of the personal connection to flavor that we as home cooks don't necessarily have direct control over. So you've got the physical aspect, the way people's taste buds and physical connection and processing of flavor happens. And then you have the emotional impact and connection to flavor that everybody processes a little bit differently. Now, there's one more thing I want to just briefly talk about that isn't necessarily directly connected to the ingredients and the methods, although there's a lot of crossover probably in all of these categories that I'm laying out here. And that's the environmental factor of flavor. Part of it can be emotional. Part of it can relate to the food and the ingredients that you're using. But certainly the one environmental factor might be some food just taste better when they're grown in certain regions, because perhaps it's that region's climate or its soils or its growing methods and practices might be more amenable to that certain sort of a food or an ingredient. But even more so to me, this kind of bleeds over into the emotional aspect as well from the environmental viewpoint of flavor is, doesn't chili, for example, taste so much better on a cool fall or winter evening than it does, say, in the middle of a 95 degree July afternoon? It's the same dish, absolutely same dish. You're absolutely the same person eating it. But the environment in which we're consuming that food impacts the flavor in a really big way. And when I say flavor, again, I'm talking about like that capital F idea of flavor. Yes, the chili probably tastes exactly the same, but we don't enjoy it as much, right? The flavor is impacted because we're not in an environment that we enjoy it, right? That's why a cold beer tastes better on that hot July afternoon, maybe than that hot bowl of chili does. And of course, there's all sorts of cultural environmental things that can impact flavor, right? Turkey always tastes better on Thanksgiving, I think, at least. Birthday parties, special events where you're getting together with the people you love, that can all have an impact on the flavor of the food. Now, I know that all sounds kind of abstract, and to a certain degree, it is. And I could talk about this stuff a lot more than I did, and I hope I didn't bore you off with kind of my ideas of those other aspects of flavor. So let's jump in a little bit to the things that we as home cooks can more or less directly control. And those are the ingredients and the methods of what we're cooking and how flavor is impacted by those two things. Okay, I hope you don't mind. I threw in another little segment music break there to kind of wake you up after that intangible kind of conversation on flavor. But I want to get in now to what I would call the ingredients and the methods aspects of flavor. And again, as I mentioned a second ago, these are the things that we as home cooks can control more or less completely, you know, with a few exceptions we'll talk about. Now, I'm going to set this up as sort of talking about general rules of flavor that I've come to learn and understand and use. You know, cooking and making food is a huge world, and there's no way I could cover every idea or aspect of boosting flavor or getting the most flavor out of your food than there possibly is to talk about. So I'm going to touch on a few basic concepts here. Again, your mileage may vary. You may not necessarily be able to use all of these in every situation. In fact, you certainly won't be able to, but I hope this gives you some stuff to chew on, so to speak, as you're kind of starting to master your own ideas of flavor and how to improvise food, or how to even take a recipe that you like and make it better by understanding a little bit more about flavor. You know, one thing I didn't mention at the beginning, but I'm going to pop it in right here real quick. If this is of real interest to you, if you're really excited about flavor, both the capital F and the little F flavor ideas that I'm talking about here, then you really owe it to yourself to check out The Flavor Bible by Karen Page and Andrew Dornenberg. It's a really great reference book. And if you're serious about home cooking and mastering flavor and improvising food, this is something you certainly should have on your cookbook shelf with all your other books and resources. Really quickly, it's talks a little bit about the emotional and the physical aspects of flavor that I covered a few minutes ago. But more than that, it's sort of a compendium of ingredients. And it's a great quick reference book because it talks about what goes good with certain ingredients, not only from a taste perspective, but from a weight of the ingredient perspective. They also use a term called the volume of the ingredient. So for example, from a volume perspective, like a russet potato would be very low volume, whereas a habanero chili would be very loud volume, right? Because one is hot and spicy and jumps right to the front of the dish, whereas a potato might recede into the background and not lend a lot of unique characteristics of flavor to a dish. But it's an excellent resource. I have it in my hand right here. Just to give you an example, it talks a lot about complementary flavor. So I'm just going to pop it open to a page and see what we have here. So for example, I opened it up to cucumbers. So it talks about the season, the taste, what kind of a function it has. So I'll just read this to you. So it talks about its taste, which is sweet and astringent. It has a cooling function in recipes. It's a lightweight and it has a quiet volume. So this is some of the characteristics of cucumber. Then it goes into a list of other ingredients and foods that complement cucumbers from a flavor profile. So some of the big things that it calls out as absolute great matches: dill, garlic, mint, onions, of course, and vinegar are the really big ones. Some less obvious ones might be cilantro, flatleaf parsley, black pepper, sugar, tomatoes as well, you know, are complementary to cucumbers. And there's a list of probably 30 or 40 more other ingredients that are complementary to cucumber from a flavor perspective as well. So it's a fun resource if you're improvising in the kitchen or you're trying to make a recipe better to find out what other foods might go well with what it is you're working with at the time. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/122, but that's The Flavor Bible by Page and Dornenberg. Okay. All right. So let's dive into some actual tips on using on food from an ingredients and a methods perspective. I guess I'll tackle this as kind of a listicle, if you will, just a list of items that I have written down here. And again, you won't be able to use all of these all of the time, but I think these are foundational ideas when it comes to flavor. So first and foremost, to me, the quality of your ingredients is critical, right? So the ingredients that you're using will directly impact the flavor of your final recipe. And probably the biggest way that matters is in produce, right? Fresh and local fruits and vegetables are generally going to yield a lot more flavor than fruits and vegetables that aren't in season or aren't quite ripe or aren't quite fresh, right? So here in Oregon, for example, a strawberry that you're going to find at the local farmer's market in mid-July, for example, is going to be orders of magnitude more flavorful than the strawberries you're going to find in the supermarket in the middle of January that are probably trucked in from southern climate somewhere that probably were picked when they weren't quite ripe because they didn't want them to go bad in transit and so on. So that's just one very specific example of how local and in-season food is going to be more flavorful than not. Also, when it comes to ingredients, keep an eye out for heirloom varieties. Most of the fruits and veggies you find in your supermarkets, perfectly serviceable, perfectly functional for your recipes. But, you know, a tomato that you just find, the hothouse tomatoes that you find in the grocery store are going to be not nearly as flavorful as an heirloom variety of tomatoes, again, which is by its very definition, probably, and where you're at, is going to have been grown locally and picked at the peak of its freshness, right? I always talk about apples as well. This is another good example from the fruit side of the aisle. you know, grocery store apples, there's five or six varieties that you always see, you know, Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, Granny Smith, Honeycrisp now seems to be everywhere. And, you know, and there's a couple more. But, you know, those apples have been grown and bred in such a way that they last a long time in storage, that they don't bruise as easily, that they look nicer on the shelf than maybe a funky looking Gravenstein apple that you pull off the tree in the orchard. But I guarantee you that Gravenstein apple is going to be a lot more flavorful. It actually tastes like something as opposed to, say, a Red Delicious apple, which tastes like nothing. And then the last thing I want to say about the quality of ingredients is that don't overlook the frozen ingredients. If you're not in a place where you can get a nice fresh strawberry, check out the frozen strawberries. A lot of times those are picked at the peak of ripeness and freshness, and they're frozen right away. So while it's not like walking to the farmer's market in the middle of July in Oregon and grabbing a crate of fresh strawberries, it's probably the next best thing, especially if you're using it in some sort of a sauce or dessert or something like that. Okay, so the quality of your ingredients is very important. Okay, the rest of these don't really go in any particular order, but the second thing I would say about flavor is start to gain an understanding about what layering flavors means. You hear this all the time in cooking TV shows, oh, I'm layering flavors, I'm building flavors. Well, what exactly does that mean? And the way I describe that, or the way I would explain that, is this way. Everything you do to the ingredients that you're working with affects flavor in some way. Sometimes it affects flavors dramatically, and sometimes it almost does nothing to the flavor of the dish. But there's this spectrum. No ingredient passes through your hands when you're making a recipe where you're not somehow altering the characteristics and the flavor of that. So looking for opportunities to fortify the flavors of your ingredients as you're cooking is really important, because once you get to the end of your dish, once you're done cooking and your recipe is finished, you know, you're done with opportunities to build flavor into that dish, aside from maybe hitting it with a little acid or a little bit of salt or something like that, or a condiment, okay? But you're done with the really big, awesome ways to fortify flavor in your dish. So here's one example of that. I've got this chicken pot pie recipe, which I really like. It's fairly standard, and I can't remember where I found it online years and years ago, but and I even have it written this way on the card that I wrote it down on, but I never changed it. I just changed it in my mind. But it calls for vegetables and chicken, like chicken pot pie does. But the way it wants you to prepare those vegetables and chicken, it wants you to boil them. So you take your carrots and your celery and your corn and your potatoes, and you boil them with the chunks of your chicken. And then you drain them, and now you've got the cooked bits that are going to go into the filling for your chicken pot pie. Now, that is a massive missed opportunity, the way that recipe is written, to build in a ton of flavor into that chicken pot pie dish. So what I do instead to fortify and to layer in flavor is I saute all the vegetables in a little bit of olive oil until hit them with a little salt until they start to get a little soft and they start to turn a little bit brown. I'm adding a lot more flavor to those vegetables than just boiling them in water when I do that. And then instead of boiling the chicken, I like to poach the chicken in a little bit of wine and chicken broth and maybe a sprig of rosemary in there as well. And I cook them that way rather than boiling them, because your chicken is going to take on the flavor of that poaching liquid and the herbs. Not only that, when the chicken pot pie recipe later on calls for chicken broth, I'm going to have some poaching liquid, some very flavorful poaching liquid that I can save and then add into that step, which will build more flavor. So that's just one example about how the way you cook the components of your recipe are going to layer and fortify flavor and going to add so much to your final dish. In some cases, it might take a little longer. Yes, it's much faster just to boil some vegetables and chicken and be done with it. But to me, if you're going to take the time to make a recipe like chicken pot pie, you might as well take a few extra minutes and really kick the flavor up to 11. Okay. So that's what layering flavor means. It means looking for opportunities to boost and fortify the flavor of your recipes as you go along. Because like I said, once you get to the end, you're losing opportunities to boost the flavor. So here's another concept for flavor, and that is the longer that you cook ingredients together, the less distinct their flavors will become. That's not to say it's bad. It just means you're going to end up with a different type of dish if you understand that when you cook ingredients together for longer periods of time, you're going to lose those distinctive characteristics of those ingredients. It's going to come together, and the sum of those individual parts is going to make something better in the end, but it's going to be a different product than if you just throw everything together and eat it, right? So on the one end of the spectrum, you've got recipes that have distinct ingredients that generally stay that way, right? So think like a fresh salad, to be completely basic about it. So when you put a salad together with different ingredients, when you eat that salad, all those ingredients are going to taste like those individual ingredients. You're going to be able to taste the cucumber slices. You're going to be able to taste the tomatoes. You're going to taste the cheese or whatever it is you've got in that salad. You're going to be able to taste those individual components. They'll work together to make something delicious. But on the other end of the spectrum, you have ingredients that cook together for a long period of time. So think of something like a slow braise or a stew, in which case the ingredients you put in that stew are going to taste less like themselves and more like a symphony of all of those ingredients working together. So one real world example I will give you, and this I will include the recipe for over again at the show notes, is jambalaya. So jambalaya, one of my absolute favorite things to make, one of my absolute favorite things to eat. Jambalaya, if you're not familiar with it, is a rice dish of Cajun origin. So it comes from Louisiana. And its primary ingredients are rice and then some sort of seafood, usually shrimp or perhaps crawfish, and usually some sort of a pork as well. In most cases, you'll see it with like an andouille sausage. That's the way I like to make it, and also with chicken. So I do the three. I do shrimp, chicken, and andouille sausage. And I do a Creole version of jambalaya, which means it has tomatoes in it as well. And it takes a couple hours to cook. And it has several steps, like you're making the holy trinity of Cajun cooking, or you could call it like a mirepoix of Cajun cooking. It's onion, celery, and bell pepper. So you cook those into some olive oil and let them soften up and start to brown. And then in goes garlic, tomatoes, Worcestershire sauces, some hot sauce, some Cajun seasoning, bay leaves. It's a flavorful broth, and then rice. And then that comes to a simmer, and then we cook that for about a half an hour until those flavors start to meld. And then in go the meat, the shrimp, the chicken, the sausage, and then that gets simmered for another 25 or so minutes. And then this all gets added together. It gets cooked for a while until everything starts to contribute. Every individual distinct ingredient's flavor starts to contribute to the overall dish. The rice takes on this beautiful kind of brown, gooey consistency, texture, and color. It starts absorbing the flavor from the meats and the shrimp that are in the dish. The trinity of the onion and the celery and the bell pepper, they've receded to the background, but they've added that beautiful aromatic complexity overall to the dish. And you just end up with this ultimate comfort food in my mind. It doesn't taste like any one of those particular ingredients, but the sum of all the individual parts, of course, come together and it just makes something fantastic. But it takes a little bit of time to make. It's not like a 4 or 5 hour or a half a day or an all day simmer sort of a thing, but it's not necessarily a super quick dish. So I thought, what would happen if I tried to make a jambalaya? That was a quick dish. So I had all of the ingredients. I had a little bit of all the ingredients left over. So I made another smaller batch of jambalaya. And what I did was I said, I am just going to take the longest cooking ingredient in here, which is the rice. So let's just say 15 minutes. I'm going to make a jambalaya in 15 minutes. So I put all of, instead of, doing the different steps like I just briefly outlined a second ago, I just put it all in at once, all the rice, all the meat, all the vegetables, everything. And I cooked it for 15 minutes, so everything was cooked, and it was done. And I tried it, and it was not that surprising. I kind of figured I knew what was going to happen. And that is, while it wasn't awful, it was tasty, it was colorful, it had good flavor. But whatever else it was, it wasn't jambalaya. It was a rice dish that had a lot of very distinct ingredients that were all sort of clamoring for the lead position. I don't know how else to explain that. I could taste the bell peppers. I could taste the celery. I could taste the onion. They were all still a little bit crunchy. They had a little bit of a bite to them. But they all tasted like themselves. Of course, the shrimp and the sausage and the chicken all tasted like shrimp, sausage, and chicken. The rice kind of tasted like white rice that had other stuff mixed into it. It was just missing that cohesion, right? That depth of flavor that jambalaya has. Again, it wasn't bad. It just wasn't satisfying. It wasn't jambalaya. It was certainly something I wouldn't turn away. I would definitely eat it. But again, like I said, whatever else it was, it wasn't jambalaya. So that's an example of how cooking things together makes all the ingredients less distinctive, but then adds so much more to the final dish. I know I went on and on about that particular step, probably because it's one of my favorite cooking methods. Okay, let's go on to another idea about flavor. And this one is fairly specific. This is that fat carries flavor, and your fat in your dish can decide the overall flavor profile of your final dish. So be very cognizant of what kind of fat you're using in your dish. So, I mean, I can think of very few recipes where fat is not included in the recipe. A dish without fat is just not going to be a flavorful dish, unless it's compensating with very loud, forward-facing flavors in other ways. Like, for example, pickled cucumbers don't have any fat, and it's a very flavorful dish. That's because you've got the salt and the acid, or perhaps a ferment going on, and it comes forward flavorful in other ways, but it's certainly not relying on fat. But anything you're generally cooking, you're going to need some sort of a fat. Sometimes it's fat that you add directly, like oil when you're cooking your vegetables, or butter, or perhaps the main source of the fat comes from some of the ingredients itself, like a fatty cut of pork or beef, for example. But fat does carry flavor. So when you're looking at ways to make your food healthy, and I'm all for that, cutting down fat, just remember that fat does serve a purpose in the overall flavor of your food. So if you're really looking for that dynamite dish to make for somebody's party, go crazy, make it full fat. If you're looking to cut the fat out of your daily, you know, cooking to make food a little bit healthier for your family, like I said, I'm all for that. But fat is what's really going to deliver a lot of flavor. And then, you know, right on the other side of that coin is that your salt should not be overlooked when you're looking to kick the flavors up of your dishes. Now, it certainly should be used judiciously. You don't want to oversalt your dishes. That can ruin a dish faster than anything, especially, you know, if you need to watch your sodium intake. Obviously, you have to be very careful about this. But more often than not, I see people under-season, under-salt their dishes than the opposite. And to me, an under-seasoned dish, yes, even though you can add salt at the end at the table, it just lacks that, I don't know what, just that wow factor, that well-rounded flavor if you under-salt it. I always recommend salting and tasting as you go if it makes sense in your recipe. And remember, as you're cooking, as you're reducing liquids in your dishes, your flavors will intensify and concentrate, especially salt. So while you're going along, it may seem like your dish isn't overly salty, but if you cook it and reduce it down, you could get to an overly salted dish, and then you're going to have to dilute it down with some more liquid, and then you're not in a real great place if that happens. But salt is important when it comes to flavor. And also keep an eye open for ingredients in your recipes that are salty, so you don't overdo it. You know, like Parmesan cheese is a great example. If you're using Parmesan, Parmesan is inherently a bit salty, so you can be careful when you're adding salt and seasonings in other places, if you know you're going to be getting an influx of Parmesan cheese, for example, because that's going to make up for it a bit. All right, I've got a couple more flavor ideas here. Of course, spices, not salt, but other spices contribute interest and mystery to a dish, especially if you don't necessarily expect to find them there. If you're making a curry, then obviously you're going to have curry in your dish. But I always like to make, for example, if I'm doing a tomato soup, I always like to put a little bit of yellow curry powder into the mix because it adds this warmth and this sort of a mysterious note to a tomato soup. It doesn't turn it into a curry, but it just adds a little something where you say, like, what is that? That's very interesting. And it just makes your dish much more flavorful and therefore much more exciting. So that's just one little example. But think of ways you can incorporate spices into your food to add a little more interest, not necessarily change the overall course of the recipe, but just add a little more interest. Other examples would be, for example, a little bit of cinnamon in a beef braise, maybe, or a little bit of cocoa in your chili. Those sorts of things are always interesting and can round out your flavor profile of any particular dish. Another very important component of flavor, acid. Acid wakes up your tongue. Acid can do a lot for a dish. It can do much like salt can do, where it can sort of balance bitter flavors in a dish, brighten up the dish, make your dish more palatable, more interesting, more bright, if you will. It's amazing what a squeeze of lemon can do on a really rich, creamy dish, or just a really rich dish with a lot of muted flavors. It can really pull out flavors. It won't taste like lemon in the end, but it's just going to kind of ride on the top of all of these other flavors and sort of bring it out. And of course, you could use other acids like, you know, vinegar, of course, is another common kitchen acid that you could use. Use it judiciously, you know, a little too much, and then you don't want things to start tasting pickled. But just think of acid. Now, I'm talking about acid at the end of the dish. Also think of ways to incorporate acid into the cooking process. So remember a few minutes ago, I talked about that chicken pot pie recipe where I like to poach the chicken with a little broth and white wine. Well, that white wine is adding a little bit of acid to that dish. So there are ways you can work in the acid that isn't just all about squeezing lemon on at the end. So look for ways you can add a little bit of acid into the cooking process as well. And that will help fortify flavors sort of during the cooking process. Okay, last one, and then we'll wrap this up. And I want to give a shout out to some condiments, because well-placed condiments can make a huge difference in the flavor profile and the final flavor of your particular recipes. One of my favorite things is Worcestershire sauce. If I'm making a creamy dish, I love to just to put a shot of Worcestershire sauce in there because it adds this umami flavor. It kind of adds this slightly acidic undercurrent into this rich, creamy, you know, perhaps a cheesy dish or something like that. So that's one of my favorite things to do. Mustard, brown mustard, Dijon mustard is also nice to use in small doses. It will add a little bit of bite, a little bit of that kind of sharp undercurrent to really rich dishes. Anchovy paste, not necessarily a condiment, but it can be used as such in tomato sauce, is amazing. Of course, there's a whole variety of cuisines that have some pretty amazing condiments. I'm thinking fish sauce, or even like sriracha or things like that in different Asian cuisines. So think about the way condiments can be used. They're not necessarily discrete individual ingredients that you go and buy at the store, but they're things you can have in your fridge or your pantry that can add a little bit of, what was that? Much in the way I mentioned the spices could do a few minutes ago. So look at the way condiments can help build out your flavor profile of a dish. And remember, when you're tasting your dish and you say it's a little flat, it's kind of dull, it's kind of rich, you know, look for something with some acid, for example, to brighten that up. And go back to episode 78 to listen to the five tastes if you want some more information about how the taste thing works. All right, I've probably rambled on long enough about flavor. Again, big topic, and I know there's so much more to talk about, but I hope by breaking it down into a couple of different ideas, you know, the physical and the emotional and the mental side of flavor, and then the side of flavor that comes right from your ingredients and the way you cook those ingredients and how they perhaps complement or contradict one another often. But I think understanding how that interplay works and exploring it and thinking in your own situations how those things are at work and affect the way you perceive flavor or the way your family perceives the flavor of food, I think is interesting, at least, and at best, it will help you refine the way you cook the food that you're cooking at home and just make it a better experience for everybody. All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much once again for tuning in to the Kitchen Counter Podcast today. Again, for the show notes for this episode, head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/122, and you'll see that jambalaya recipe and a link to go check out the flavor Bible. And I haven't written the show notes yet, so who knows, maybe a couple of other things, but go and check that out and enjoy. If you haven't been over to the Facebook group yet, kitchencounterpodcast.com/group will take you right over there, or send an email over to me at feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. So that does it for one more episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. There will be more goodness coming your way soon. And back by popular demand, I hope, I'm working on getting this one finished, my friend Chris and I might have another Halloween episode up our sleeves for you. We're working on that because everybody liked that one we did last year so much. We're going to pull one together this year for you. All right, everybody. Thank you once again for listening to the Kitchen Counter Podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, Roger. Happy cooking.